Hi, my name is Steve Otto, and I'm 59 years old. I live in Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to be interviewing with my Aunt Sherilyn. I grew up in Lewiston and currently in Moscow. My grandmother, Marjorie, who we're going to be talking about, lived in Julietta. And so, Sherilyn, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Long. It's Sherilyn Bruce Whittam Pettigo. And my age is 61. Today's date is July 18th, 2020. I'm in Tillamook, Oregon. And the name of my partner here is my brother's son, Steve Otto, my nephew. And I will be talking about the unique relationship we have in that my mother is his grandmother. And how the role she played in our life in the Lewiston Clark Valley, where she was a native. Her name is Marjorie Otto Whittam Pettigo.
Thank you. I was going to say, Sherilyn, thank you for getting the date in there. I forgot the date. It is Saturday, July 18th.
Yeah, time goes so fast.
Yes.
My mom, your grandma Margie, died in January of 2008, and she did turn 90 years old that month that she had passed on to be with the Lord. So I thought it's kind of unique in our family in that I'm 61, you're 59, and you're one of my younger nephews. I have nieces and nephews who are 10 years older than me. Because we have what I call the first family and the second family. The first family is your descent is when mom was married to Art Otto in the 1930s. She had four children, and one of them was Ray, your dad. And then she later married my dad in the 1950s and had my brother and I. So your dad is 20 years older than me. So my brothers and sisters are 20 years older than I. And that made for you and I to be kind of more like cousins growing up, I think.
Yeah.
How did you feel coming up to my mom's house, coming to our place, when it was your grandma you were going to see?
Yeah, in Julietta, I came from a house of five boys, and I'm the oldest. So it always took a lot of energy to round us up and get us going. It was a road trip to Julietta. It must be maybe 30 miles.
20,
yeah. Mm-hmm. It felt like a long trip. I can remember mm-hmm. loading up in the 1963 Lincoln Continental and probably no seat belts, and away we'd go. My dad would go up and spend a lot of time working on projects at Marjorie's house. Could be plumbing projects or just fixing up things around the place, visiting. So that gave me and my brothers time to run around in Julietta. I got fond memories of that. I remember there's a castle in that town.
Yes.
The old general store had the wood floors that would creak when you'd go in there.
Mm-hmm.
We'd take our pennies, and you could actually buy something with pennies.
Yes.
Ride our bikes around a lot. And trip, I always enjoyed the trip to Julietta from Lewiston, just because I'd usually see some deer or go along the river, and it was a good chance to get out of the town. And then running around in Julietta was always fun.
Julietta, now that I've lived in cities, when I look back at my hometown, a population of 368 when I was there, seems like it was just all one big neighborhood.
Yes.
So being around town wasn't really town. And being able to hike up in the mountains, we could do that. But I also remember before my dad died, here's another parallel that we have is your dad is my brother Ray, and Ray was 13 when his father died.
Right.
And so mom was widowed at that point in time with four teenagers to raise.
Right.
And Ray was the youngest. And then when my dad died, I was 13, the same age as Ray. And mom had again the two teenagers to raise. But Ray, your dad, stepped in a lot as an elder brother to be kind of a father figure for me. So in a sense, my older brother was like a father to me as well as to you.
Yeah.
And the flip flop is later when Ray made the property available at your place for mom to buy a trailer, and he made a place for her. She called it a house built of love. So she was there when you were in high school, and it seems the Auto Boys, which are the older, gravitated to mom almost like another mother, as well as a grandmother.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
So our families have overlapped in strange ways, in that I'm two generations removed from mom. And she's your grandma, and she's kind of my grandma. She was like a mom to you, and she was my mom.
So that's right.
Honor her with our conversations, but also just to get to know each other better, too.
I've got a fond memory in Julietta. Obviously, you're a little older than me, but you had a motorcycle that you liked to drive, and you took me on the road back behind Julietta. It was paved, thank goodness, because you terrified me. You scared me to death. And, I mean, you going into those corners fast, and, you know, I was trying to lean with you, and I don't think I'd ever been on a motorcycle yet, and that was exhilarating.
I was 13, and you were 11,
yeah.
And what? You said you were scared to death?
Oh, yes, very much so.
But you kept coming. You kept going on the rides.
You know, I love risk, so I guess that maybe it all began right then.
Your adrenaline rush.
Yes.
Auntie Sherilyn's motorcycle.
Yeah,
I did start driving cars and motorcycles when I was 13. My mom's hips were in bad shape, and she could not maneuver the clutch on our three-pedaled car, so she started having me drive her. And I had a growth spurt. I became 5'6" when I was 12, so I could handle the pedals. And I love speed too.
Now, Marjorie married Art when she was 14 or 15?
13.
13. So
my mom, your granddad, he was 19 and she was 13. And they lived, mom lived on a farm up out of in Nez Perce County. And Aunt Gladys, mom's older sister, had been what they called wild in the 1920s, flappers, I guess. And so my grandma, mom's mom, herded off her daughter to a Catholic nunnery up in Spokane and forced Aunt Gladys to chill out in the nunnery because she was a boy chaser. She came back and she said, Marjorie, she's all 5 years older than mom, so she says to 13-year-old mom, Marjorie, if you're going to marry Art, you better do it now because mom's going to send you to the nunnery next. So my mom and Art and his sister and one other friend drove down to Clarkston, Washington, out of state. Mom lied and said 16, and they were married in Clarkston, Washington, down there. And so they came back to up on the prairie where they live and told my grandma, well, I'm married now, mom said. What are you going to do about it? And she said, nothing. Get out of here. So mom got to move in with Art and his sister. Mom was best friends with her 16-year-old sister. So mom had four children while she was a teenager. And that's what I call the first family. My mom had four children by the time the Great Depression moved in. So they were raising their family up on the Lehigh Prairie. Your dad was raised up at Lehigh on a farm. And she said, we never knew the Depression was going on. I mean, this was how we lived all the time. Until her husband, your grandpa, got a job with the highway department. I think the WPA works program kicked in later in the 1930s. And that's why they moved to Lewiston and raised your dad and his brothers and sisters in Lewiston. He got a good job during the Depression. And they were married happily for 25 years until your grandfather at 40 died of a heart attack in the doctor's office. So 40 years old, mom's 36 years old, and she has these four teenagers to raise. And that's what she did, but 3 years later she married my dad and moved to Julietta, 20 miles up the Clearwater River. So Ray was kind of left hanging from what your Aunt Margie had said. He was 13, his mom just got remarried. He didn't exactly like my dad, you know, a new stepfather. So
right.
He stayed with his older brother Ralph at the family home and finished high school until he married your mom.
And then he joined the National Guard not too long after that, full time. I mean, I think he kind of lied about his age and started eventually working at the National Guard. I know he had other jobs before that, but because he was there 30 years in Lewiston with the National Guard. So,
my dad
would talk about that hard time after Art had passed away, and the dynamics of the family were, it was pretty hard. And I know the woman that I knew as a grandmother, she did go through a lot of crazy stuff at a pretty young age. So I love her dearly, and knowing some of that past and how hard things had been, to, you know, the way she exited out of here, it was really pretty something amazing. I can remember interviewing her in high school about the Depression, and yeah, I agree. She said, you know, we didn't even know there was one. I mean, they had their chickens and cows and their farm, mm-hmm. and they're living the same way they always had. So,
I forgot that you had already done an oral history interview with her.
Yeah.
Time. She was so proud of you. Being Ray's oldest son, and a lot of mantle of the responsibility has gone on your shoulders, I think, since Ray died. When your dad died, it was 1990, I believe.
Yeah.
I know I was in nursing school at that time. And Ray was the only one of my brothers and sisters to tell me, "You're really getting it together. I'm really proud of you. I'm so glad that you're in nursing school and doing something constructive with your life." And I was, you know, I got a lot of mileage out of that. You know, a little compliment, encouragement can go a long way. And that was Ray's nature. Would you like to tell me a little bit more about when Ray had a near-death experience, when your dad either died, his brother, or my brother Jerry, appeared to him in the hospital? Do you know about that?
Sure. He did pass away in 1990, but there was an experience in the hospital. I can't remember what year it was. I mean, we were living up in Moscow raising our family, but my dad called me. It might have been a Sunday morning, I can't remember, but it was basically the day after the surgery, and I didn't even recognize his voice. I thought it was some kid prank calling me. Because my dad was saying, "You got to come down here. I'm in the hospital. You got to talk to me. I've had something happen." And he just sounded so wound up. As like, is this Ray really?
He's really back. Yeah.
And so I went down. He had surgery for arterial sclerosis. He was a smoker, and they had gone in to remove the plaque in his veins in his neck. And after he was out of the surgery, in his room late at night, he said that his brother Jerry came and visited him. He felt the presence of his father, Art. Jerry had drowned in the river as a young man, actually trying to save my grandmother and also Marcy, right? I think out of the river. And he did save both of them, but he ended up drowning. So Jerry was only 19 maybe when he, or 18?
20 years old.
He had
just married and had a 10-month-old daughter, which was Jerry Ann.
Right. And so my dad's telling me the story, and he said, honestly, he thought that this visit from his brother, that he was going insane. And so he was really worried about his mental health. But then he said he heard Jerry laugh.
Yeah.
And, he said that was his laugh, and he knew that he was present with him. And then he also felt the presence of his father. Mm-hmm. Now, he told me that he went next door to the chapel, because the Catholic Church was right next to St. Joseph's. But I'm not sure physically he could have done that, but at least he felt like he was in the church.
The chapel inside the hospital.
The chapel. Now, that would make a little more sense.
Hospital.
Mm-hmm. And basically, the message that Jerry was trying to give him was just relax and take it easy and rest. My dad, like Sherilyn had shared, he kind of grew up at a young age and had really spent his life, serving and loving other people. And this was just a time out for him. So he was obviously on a medical leave, left the National Guard, and he was just supposed to take it easy. And that's what he did, for the number of years that God gave him between that experience and when he did pass away. But I have no doubt that he experienced that. So I think actually on his tombstone, it says two angels came, and that would have been Jerry and Art that visited him. So, yeah.
He told me that that they guided him down the hallway to the chapel at St. Joseph in Lewiston, and that when they went in the chapel, there was a statue of Jesus, like most Catholic chapels have. And Jerry walked over to that statue and said, "Follow him," pointing to the statue of Jesus. And Ray then asked him, how was he supposed to follow him? How do you follow Christ? Because he had only used Christ in swear words up to that point.
Sure.
Jerry, the angel, the apparition or the presence spirit, told him to search for his inner sanctuary.
That's a good word. I hadn't heard that part of the story.
That it was an interior spiritual awakening through following Christ. And I know that I've had an abrupt change at age 18 from being a hippie in 17 to finding Christ in my inner sanctuary too, which changed my whole lifestyle. I'd like to hear from you how you were born into the family of God, how you came to faith in Christ.
I kind of, being the firstborn, I think I followed in my father's steps as far as what was shown to me was, you work hard. He started working at a young age. I was working full time by the time I was 14, actually at the grocery store that he used to work at, that his friend now owned, Mylan Nordine. And so by 15, I had my own dental plan, my car, my checking account, very independent. And I was living outside of the home. We had the main farmhouse, my dad's shop, which was half of, had an apartment on one side, and Stan and I lived there. By 15.
In your high school year.
Yeah, high school year. So would have been about, I think, my sophomore year. I could describe it as the worst day of my life and the best night of my life. I saw some really wrong things inside of me personally, and I saw a lot of wrong things in the world. And it honestly didn't make any sense to stick it out and even be part of this thing. So
you mean life?
Yeah, I was going to take my life. And I was 15. I was out in the yard between the two houses. It was raining and late at night. And I'm just, I said, "Hey, God, if you're even out there, I don't even know if you are. If you're there, you need to show up, because I'm going to check out. If there's really no point in going on." I went into the apartment and turned on a little black and white TV. and Billy Graham crusades were on. He was giving the gospel message. I remember thinking to myself, well, you know, that's kind of weird. I did just ask about this. But then I also thought to myself that the gospel message was too simple. But I went ahead and received that, and I did commit my heart to the Lord, and I was radically transformed to where I became a lover of people. A lover of people. Now, Marjorie showed that to me, too. So I had an example, but I didn't personally know what that was like. And so, I at the time was dating my wife, Sandra. We've been married 40 years now. And, you know, I'm glad that I got put on a reset there. It, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned that my dad had that experience with the angels and they told him to find his inner sanctuary.
Yeah.
My favorite psalm in the Bible is Psalm 51. And there's one word in there that I've been trying to tear apart that I can't really find a definition for. And it's where the psalmist David, he calls it your inmost place. And the only way I can describe it for me, what it's meant to me personally, is like the core of who you are. It's like it's like your blueprint. It's the thing that God worked with to build you around. And so that inner sanctuary thing, I know what you're talking about there, and I think that's what my dad experienced. And I did see him have peace. You know, his health wasn't good, but he did have peace up to the day that he passed away. You know,
he was so much more emotional, like a lot of people after a stroke, but it was a spiritual kind of acceptance. He cried easily when I was with him.
Yes.
And he'd never done that before. In fact, when I became a believer in Jesus, he mocked me and teased me and, you know, just gave me a hard time about it. But here he is now trying to share his spiritual experience. I'm looking in Psalm 51. Are you talking about creating me a clean heart, God, and renew a resolute spirit, which could be expanded on, a resolute spirit?
Right. Yeah. Different versions talk about an inmost place within
inmost
that psalm.
Place.
Yeah. But yeah, Marjorie, you know, I can remember there was a hard day where she was in the nursing home, and we had just been told that Natalie and her entire family and once a neighbor child had died of carbon monoxide on Lake Dvorak. They had started a space heater inside the boat and sealed the boat, and it took everybody out. Mm-hmm. And I was with Marjorie that day, and Ron was there also, your brother. And I believe one of my brothers was there too, maybe Stan or Scott. But I knew we had to let her know that Natalie, her grandchild, had passed away. And what a tragedy this was. Here she's already lost two husbands and three sons, and she wasn't in the best of health.
Yeah.
And so we did break this news to her, and the woman ended up lifting our spirits.
Mom
she,
did.
She did. She ended up praying for us.
Oh.
And I just saw this kind of strength that it's really not of this world. I mean, she was loving on us and helping us grieve. It's just like,
you were sent there and had done that because I was out at Marcy's house when the sheriff came to tell her that her daughter and grandson and son-in-law had all died in the boat of carbon monoxide poisoning. And I was with Marcy when that news came to her, and I was behind her. So she fainted, and I held her in my arms. In Marcy, and I held her. I sat down and just tried to steady her. And then Rosalie and I were there, my sister Rosalie, and we were driving from Marcy into Lewiston to go to Mom's house to break the news to her. And you guys had done that.
Yeah.
I'm shocked. I didn't know that piece of the puzzle that day because I was dreading going to tell Mom she'd lost another grandchild.
Yeah.
So God bless you. I didn't know that you had Ron help her there.
Yeah.
And she helped you.
She did. Yeah.
Her smile was always so effervescent.
Yes.
That was one of the legacies she passed on to me. She said, if you find someone who doesn't have a smile, give them one of yours.
There you go. And she had kind of a twinkle in her eye, like she was always up to something.
Yeah.
That was really cool. It was like a kid.
Yeah. I'm not sure that she grew up past being 13 years old when she married the party. She was like another kid.
Yeah.
Then we have role reversal when, as her daughter, I became more of the parental figure because I had to make decisions for her. And that was different. I remember having mom with me one time. We would, after Christmas, we would go to Christmas Eve service for Candlelight Communion. Then we would drive around the Lewis Clark Valley to look at all the Christmas lights. And it was a joyous time. We would sing Christmas carols together, and mom was always so effervescent. So we were driving around, and then I was kind of thirsty, and I said, well, let's go through McDonald's. And so we went through the drive-thru, and I said, mom, what would you want? And she said, I'll have the child's specialty, and there was a little doll that came with it. And I just went, oh man, this role reversal literally happened. Mom's acting like a kid and she orders the kid's plate.
Sure.
And then she likes the little dolls she got with it.
Yeah.
So
she had real rosy cheeks too. I mean, like, uh-huh. You know, like a Campbell soup baby.
Yeah.
Cheeks with that grin and the cheeks and the twinkle in her eyes.
Right now, I have the picture of her that Ronnie and Risa had blown up at her funeral to use, and they were going to throw it away. And I said, "Oh no!" And it fit perfectly inside my suitcase, so I still have that picture. It's 12 years old now, of mom in her prime look of joy and glory. She prayed for you guys. When she lived in your backyard,
yeah.
It was kind of odd that all you boys were out of the main house and you lived in the clubhouse.
Yeah, bunkhouse.
The what?
Bunkhouse.
Bunkhouse, that's what it's called. That's right. So she always wanted to have her door open. And she said she remembered the first thing that you kids would say when you came through the door was, Grandma, do you have?
Yeah.
You got this, Grandma. Have you got that? And she always did, because she was a pack rat. And your mom does it. Your mom checks things out. Mom saves all the little drawings and things in your guys' years.
Okay. Yes. I'm just trying to, you know, the visions I got in my mind of her mannerisms. She was a hand talker. I mean, she was, when she was verbalizing, she was always moving. Now, look, I catch myself doing the same thing, but she was animated. We used to call it writhing in her recliner.
Writhing?
Yeah, because the arms are going and she's moving back and forth and very animated. I mean, she held your attention, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, for an hour and a half.
Oh, easily, yeah. And it's like, come up for air, Marjorie.
Have a break.
Yeah. But then she had that real sweet side to her where, you know, she would, you know, hold my face and kiss my cheek. And just so gentle and sweet and kind of, I mean, the perfect grandma.
Right.
Yeah.
She did tell a story one time when a picture of her was taken at my grandma's house. And she was going like this in the picture. And she goes, oh, yes, that's my French blood showing through.
Right.
French to talk with your hands.
Oh, okay.
We've inherited that, I think, through the Pettigoes.
Now, Sherilyn, you and I, we've been to the gravesite of great-great-grandpa. We have 10 minutes left. We've been to that gravesite of great-great-grandpa and that whole bloodline on Marjorie's side. Could you talk about that for a few minutes? And I'm going to run you to the restroom real quick. Is that okay, Mia, if I just use the restroom? Okay. Go ahead and talk about that bloodline on Marjorie's side. That's amazing, the history.
Okay.
I'll be right back.
All right. Steve and I, Steve's generation is the 10th generation since a Frenchman left France for the New World, and that was in 1681 when the Huguenots or the Huguenots were being persecuted by the Catholics during all of the wars they had. So he first arrived as an indentured servant. So this is our Perigo line, and they were called Perigols. His grandson and great-grandson served in the Revolutionary War. So I'm now a daughter of the American Revolution, that I found out how to do that and have applied and am an active, in an active chapter. What's interesting to me is my family, when you think about it, my grandfather, Pedro, was born the last year of the Civil War. So 1865, my grandfather was born. Pedro died. So it isn't that many generations back to the Civil War, the Revolutionary War. And this great-great-grandfather and my great-great-grandmother are buried up on outside the Lewis and Clark Valley, up on the Blue. And I've seen as one of the most interested parties for our family history that I get to pass this on to, because I don't have children of my own. And I was hoping all this family research would not go down the drain. And so Steve was receptive when I asked him, you live in Moscow, and less than 10 miles from where you live, your great-great-great-grandparents had a homestead, and they were Oregon Trail pioneers. So they went across and walked, everyone walked. They settled in the named the town of Damascus, Oregon. And 20 years later, they pulled up stakes again, and they were pioneers once again to the Palouse and the Woodland Park Valley. So they have a homestead that a cousin has taken me to. And I got Steve together last summer or the summer before, and we went bushwhacking out on the actual cabin is that they built and lived in 1871. Before there was even a county or a city there, they were the original pioneers once again. But what's odd, or not odd, but a family theme, is they were missionaries. So they were always planting churches wherever they went, and they believed in getting back to the Bible and not being just a religious, don't depend on your denomination, a personal, vibrant relationship Christ necessary. So they had home meetings. They would be what would be called the home churches. So Steve and I have gone up and cleaned up their graves up on the, it's at Eden Valley Cemetery, about 10-15 miles from Moscow, where Steve lives. And I am now going to be buried with my ashes there. My great-great-grandmother's headstone is a tall tower with four sides on it. And her best friend are both buried there and have their names on one side of that. There's two blank sides left. It stands about 4 feet tall, and it's got a little cupola at the top. And so I'm going to have my name chiseled there and have my ashes buried there, which are in a heart shape. He's going to do the burial for me. And it's got wildflower seed packet in it. So you bury me and my ashes at the foot of great-great-grandmother's headstone, and my wildflowers will bloom. And they'll feed on my ashes. And, you know, it's a, how do they say that? It's life is a circle. It all comes around. I'll be buried back at the foot of my great-great-grandmother. And that's the heritage that you have to pass on to your kids. Steve, and that you're a grandparent now.
Yes.
Can you see yourself becoming a great-great-grandfather in your lifetime if we live through the COVID virus?
Yeah, it could happen. Well, time will tell. Speaking of time, we're down to 5 minutes.
Let's wrap this up. I haven't looked at these great questions. I highlighted a few of them. But I guess I would like to ask you, is there something that you feel has given you purpose in your life? And what would that be?
You mentioned great-great-grandma and how they had this desire for the church. And you'd mentioned they had a real sense of unity was a big part of what they wanted to see. And I'd never really connected all these dots, but that is a lot that drives me. I work at a thrift store that is comprised of local churches. The board's comprised of local churches. We do jobs training for people that have, you know, maybe coming out of rehab or prison or just haven't ever held a job before. I do prison ministry. I go to the county jail. I'm not an ordained pastor, but the biggest thing that fires me up is when the churches can actually get together, get beyond their issues of doctrine and denominations that sometimes keep them divided. And actually, it's kind of like you can get more done together than individual and separate. And so I've had the privilege of seeing that played out in my life. I think Marjorie and my dad, all that bloodline, that history is something that's in that inmost place, that core that is just, I love it when it happens. So that's where I'm at.
I think that is a legacy that you've already, through your own endeavors, have striven for. You've been successful in starting the produce market and business skills, and now you're working in helping rebuild lives through the actions that you do. And that is the heritage that you have from your petty soul line. And I'm grateful for you and Sam to be in my life at this point where, again, I don't have children to bequeath my belongings, and that you stepped up to be that for me. And the fact that I would like to close to summarize my part in that my mom has always said, in the family of God, there are no grandchildren. We all each get to be an individual child of God. You can't, you know, get it from your grandparents. You are born into this new life. And now, in that your dad was like, was my brother, and like a dad to me too, you and I are now brother and sister in Christ.
That's right.
Father and mother in heaven. So I'm grateful that we have this kinship in Christ. Anything you want to summarize with me?
Yeah, we're down to, we got about 2 minutes left. So, you know, life's way more than we see it. You know, Marjorie went through a really hard stuff in her life, but she ended on a note where she was filled with joy. That was quite obvious. She always took any hardship and said, this is just her next opportunity to love on people. And she did that. And so I saw that played out, and I saw that in my father, same thing. And, you know, living a life where you sacrifice. And you end up, you're trying to bless others, not out of like obligation or duty, but just, it just happens from way down deep. And somehow in the process, you get blessed in the whole process too. But it doesn't mean that life's easy, but there can be a richness to it, even in spite of how crazy things can be, for sure. So I appreciate you, Sherilyn, taking the initiative to make this happen. And it's been a blast. Maybe we'll do it again, or encourage others to do it again, for sure. It's been a good experience.
I'd love to see you do this with your brother.
I don't know if we could handle that. You know, Smitty, my youngest, is a talker. We called him Motor Mouth, but Marjorie could out-talk him.
Those genes I do have.
All right.
That's why I wanted to give you the last word.
You bet. I think we're about wrapped up. All right. Thumbs up.